Well, everyone, it's happened. Ann Arbor AF has its very first advertiser, and truly we could not think of a better one. House Party is a week-long festival of free events raising awareness of the current housing situation in Ann Arbor and the broader trends that led us here. From Tuesday, September 12th through Sunday, the 17th, the events confront conditions around city resources, accessory dwelling units, planning policies, renters' rights, and more. Our very own Jess Letaw will be doing a panel called History to Present Day, Race and Housing in Ann Arbor. It's going to be awesome. There will also be chances to meet city staff, record your own housing story with the Ann Arbor District Library, and connect with other housing advocates from around the region. House Party is organized by Do Good Work, a local 501c3 nonprofit supporting creatives and community by turning radical ideas into positive change in the built environment. The events are a mix of in-person and online. All in-person events are in accessible locations in proximity to public transit stops. It's also free, but advance registration for some events will get you added perks like food and swag. Check out the week of events and updates at dogoodwork.org/houseparty. Find them on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or Threads at dogoodwork.org or using the hashtag houseparty82. Thanks so much to House Party for sponsoring this episode. It's going to be hard to keep it to an hour, I bet.
Oh, so much to talk about. Ugh, okay.
Let's do it.
I'm Jessica Letaw, here with co-host Molly Kleinman. We both use she, her pronouns. Molly and I think a lot about how to make cities better through affordable and abundant housing, safer transportation outside of cars, and community safety beyond law enforcement. We talk about these issues because we know whatever we're trying to accomplish, we can't do it alone. So we're right here with you, learning how to get informed so we can get involved. So welcome to Ann Arbor AF. Today, we are continuing our mini-series, Civic Therapy, conversations where we embrace the big feelings we have about public policy and public process. Today, and I know you can already hear the excitement in my voice, we are talking with Yodit Mesvin-Johnson about community-driven planning. And I don't know if we're going to talk about community engagement or not. Sort of. Yes. No. I don't know. Okay. So, Yodit, yeah. She, her, at Yodit MJ on socials, is a Black mama, an activist and strategist with an abolitionist mind and a visionary heart. Holding love as a guiding value, a way of being, an action, and a politic. Full-time, she's president and CEO of Nonprofit Enterprise at Work and founder of Black Men Read and co-founder, with me, of Future Root, a boutique consulting practice that works alongside people and cities to reckon with their histories, remember their stories of resilience and joy, and reimagine what place and home can feel like when justice, care, and safety are prioritized. The firm offers strategy, planning, and design services. Yodit is presently co-leading a community-driven planning effort in Ann Arbor for a mixed-use development being developed in an historically Black business and residential area in Ann Arbor. She also serves as an advisor to a University of Michigan research initiative documenting Black segregation, racism, and resistance in Washtenaw County. Yodit thrives in building community around questions that matter most. How can we unlock the potential and possibility needed to radically transform our communities, see the ecosystem and the whole, and design and act in ways that bend the long arc of history towards balance and harmony? My colleague, my sister friend, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. This is really exciting.
Thank you.
I love hearing your voice.
To get to be in space with the two people that I like organize with most and agitate with most and dream with most is a pleasure for me. So civic therapy, this is a very comfy therapy couch today.
Yay.
So I thought the place that we might start, Yodit, was with yours and my origin story, where we started working together, because I feel like that has a lot to do with what we're talking about today, which is the Washtenaw historical journey as part of the Champions for Change program at NU. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that program and then the journey.
Sure. Can I just say, though, that my recollection of us starting to work together was actually after I'd done a talk on reentering community with reverence for Urban Consulate. And I'll never forget you came to New, which is the biggest heart and all your notes out, you know, like ready to sit and trying to think about how to contribute yourself to community. And I just remember how joyous that conversation was, how good it felt. So yeah, then actually at that time that we met, I'd been on my own journey and curiosity. There'd been a national report about the racial leadership gap in the nonprofit and social sector. And I think like a lot of us, when you see your story told in a really public way, it was emboldening. And I got curious about what the racial leadership gap in Washtenaw County looked like. This was 2017, you know, a really precarious and dangerous time in our country, but also one where I think we were realizing that just the election of Obama alone had not made it a post-racial society. And so I did this informal study in Washtenaw County. We have 2,400 nonprofits. But a side note, that is one nonprofit for every 150 people in Washtenaw County. Y'all can put the math together. And of those 2,400 nonprofits in 2017, only 20 of them, actually 17 of them, were led by a person of color. Again, informal study, didn't include churches, but shit was bad. Fewer than 1% of the nonprofits were led by a person of color. And so I really started to think about the design of a fellowship for leaders of color. I was new in executive leadership myself and feeling all the feels about that. So Champions for Change, like a lot of work I'm involved in, was born of a need that I had and that I was hearing from others that they had. And so the fellowship was intended to help folks to examine their own identities, to examine their work around racial justice from an individual, interpersonal, institutional level. And within that, I felt like it was really important that we reckon with the city that we were in and the invisibilization and erasure of Black histories in Ann Arbor. I was shocked to learn that Wheeler Park had been named for Ann Arbor's only ever Black mayor, and that I'd been coming to a place of work around the corner from the park at that point for many years and just didn't know that. And so shout out to the African-American Cultural and Historical Museum and folks like Deb over there who've been doing underground railroad tours and other community history tours. And I just was like, oh, other people need to see and hear this. My own belief is we can't be what we can't see. And as a Black-bodied person in a majority white community, the degree of othering that happens and the sense of I don't belong here and this isn't home, even if we don't talk about it, was so pervasive and so insidious. And so I had also met Matthew Countryman, who at the time was over at the Department of African and Africana Studies. He'd spoken as a keynote at an event that I was also speaking at, and he did a 100-year retrospective of Black organizing, student organizing at U of M, and it blew my mind, y'all. And I just was like, do people, you know how you sit? I was like, do people know this? Have they heard this?
But is it just me? Right.
And so I reached out to Matthew, like really fangirling, like I was dropping names, like, okay, you know my friend who knows a friend. I would do all of these things to try to get him to come and share parts of that talk that I felt when I first heard him speak. I felt it so deep in my body, y'all. I mean, to see Black women 100 years ago organizing around housing access at the University of Michigan was just like, oh, I was so hungry and I wanted so much more and I wanted other people to have it. So I'd met you through Building Matters Ann Arbor, and you were doing some powerful work at the time as well. And so I just started to think about like, who are the people and voices that inspire me, that empower me that I want other people to meet. And so that is kind of the genesis of both Champions for Change and what we call the Washtenaw Historical Journey, which takes our fellows in that program through a literal journey of Washtenaw's racial history. It's certainly not fully comprehensive, but is intended to give leaders in this community access to that vital history.
So Molly and I are both alumni of that program. As somebody who got to help co-create it, who took it, who has contributed to being a part of that conversation ever since then, specifically for the journey, I hear from people years later who talk about how impactful that was because they're able to see their physical community with different eyes and kind of understand actually like why they're seeing what they're seeing in terms of their neighborhood composition or why the school is where it is, or, you know, folks that didn't know that Community High used to be a primarily Black elementary school, that it shifts something fundamental in how they see Ann Arbor and then how they think about Ann Arbor. Well, Ann Arbor and Washtenaw County, right? Because Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti are inextricably intertwined, but that physically moving through those spaces. And during the pandemic, the folks who moved through it, you know, virtually, but then kind of physically took the self-guided journey. It just, for me, it speaks to something that's been really urgent for me for a really long time, which is moving through spaces and how you understand that place is a really important part of how you understand yourself. As somebody who craves to work on future stuff so badly, I keep coming back to the fact that we can't do it in a robust way, especially not in a just way, without understanding our history. So getting to work on contributing to that was wonderful. And I really appreciate you bringing back our first conversation because I was fangirling you so hard. I didn't want to cite that as the beginning of our working relationship because I felt so awkward and crushy. That was when it started. So I want to bring this into what this has to do with community engagement because, I have so many things to say, but the first thing that I want to say is I am enjoying the things that I'm wrong about community engagement about. So one of them is when I say community engagement, when I think about it primarily as a thing that the city does or a thing that the government does. I think of it as a broken government process. And in talking with you, Yodit, you have a much fuller and I think a much more positive orientation towards it.
Yeah. Well, I think you know that I celebrated a significant milestone birthday this year. And what I've learned as I've gotten older is to hold nuance, that there's very little that is binary, right? So when I think about my work as a racial justice activist and organizer, so often I'm dealing with folks who are working at the downstream issue, and all of them stem from colonial, racist, sexist, you know, patriarchal, go on and on and on practices and policies, right, in this country. And so in order to look up at what are the upstream issues, we also have to interrogate what are the apparatus or tools we're using to try to deconstruct these deep upstream issues. And so I think that engagement is flawed, but I also want to hold that most of the people that I know that are doing community engagement work intend to be doing something meaningful and powerful. Mm-hmm. And yet, by design, I mean, I talked about racial leadership or lack thereof representation in our community. Often that stems from the long histories of economic inequality that's here as well, right? So the fact that folks cannot afford to, many folks, many Black folks, many working class folk, many queer folk can no longer afford to live in Ann Arbor means we have a reduced population of Black, brown, queer, and working class folk in the community, right? So now you have a city that is primarily white, mostly affluent, average median income, $120,000 a year in Ann Arbor, right? That's double what the state average income is. So we have high levels of wealth, high levels of education. You know, the city loves to tout itself as America's most educated city, America's best city to live in, one of them. But the reality is that those upstream and deeply systemic issues have moved folks out of community. And so when we have, whatever the process is, the city's running many processes, a reparations committee, a circular economy thing, a transportation initiative, what have you, and they say, we want to do community engagement, who do we want to engage? And so that's what I'm up to in thinking about what it means to not engage as an insurance policy, not to engage as a checkbox. Check, we did that thing in this laundry list of things that have to happen in transportation planning or urban planning or master planning or design, right? But that we really are shifting fundamentally how we think about community and putting them in the center, and that community is plural, as in there are many communities with many different needs. And so I want to talk to you about some of the design flaws in that too, and why I think people aren't doing more of it, why cities aren't doing more of it, despite the fact that they say they want to.
So before we get into the design flaws, can we sort of come up with a really basic definition of what we're talking about? Like, what is community engagement? And also maybe why, like, what's the stated purpose of community engagement? Like, why are cities doing it? And then why do we think cities should be doing it? But first, what is it?
Let me just throw out a basic definition, but then I would love to hear from y'all. So it is striving towards improving the quality of life in a given community in political and non-political ways. That's what engagement is. It can be, sometimes y'all use the language of public participation or civic engagement, but at its best, community engagement is interacting with, in relationship with community around projects, around ideas, around work. I lead a nonprofit organization. For us, centering community is about listening to them, designing with them, and it can involve meetings or interviews or surveys or any number of those things. All terms around civic engagement are ultimately about trying to manifest action, share knowledge, increase skills, articulate values and motivation with community. But also, what are other considerations? Like, what time's the meeting? Where's the meeting? Who are we designing for when we think about an engagement process? And my supposition is if we can design for the person we wish were in the room, but often isn't, which is what I hear a lot locally in Ann Arbor, is we can't find, or we don't know, or they don't come, or they don't show up. And some of that's true, and my assertion is that communities that have been historically marginalized, it is more costly, more time consuming to build trust, to build relationship, and to bring them into the fold. But also there's practical stuff, like I'm a mama. And if you start a city council meeting at 6 o'clock and it goes to fucking midnight or whatever, like I just can't be there. So there's things like childcare or compensation or other just practical things that we need to be thinking about and getting more proximate to impacted communities. So yes, we all love the library, but like who can get to downtown to the library? Can you do it at the community center in the neighborhood? You know, et cetera, et cetera. So those are just some of the things that over the years when I've talked to everybody from Ann Arbor School Board to local organizations, you know, just some practical things that people can latch on to help hack what's currently happening. And I think it persists in Washtenaw County because of the economic divides as well. So in Ann Arbor, I think I heard before I left, like only 7% now of the population is Black in Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. So it's a relatively small group. In a county of 350,000 people, there's only 60,000 of those people that are Black to begin with. Mm-hmm. And then the majority of Black people are experiencing compounding inequities in the county. So how are we going to think about true, meaningful engagement? And I think there has to be a monetary function of that, which is part of what we did with Catherine. You know, there's got to be elongated processes. It can't just be the, you know, one community, like when in a development project, the one community engagement or whatever it's called, meeting, there have to be multiples of that. And there has to be reckoning. That's been the theme, I think, that Jess and I have talked about, is the importance of reckoning with the history and naming that, because there's so much distrust. So I want to make it irresistible to do this, which is why I think issue identification is important, but also what's so juicy and good about a process that brings folks that we don't typically hear from. I think creativity and innovation and wonderful design happens when we do that.
Yes. Do you have anything to add to that definition or a different definition?
I'm debating how salty I want to be.
Very.
This is the therapy. Okay. So at my saltiest, which is not how I usually am, but just to get it off my therapy chest, community engagement is when you convene a room, you don't attend to any of the dynamics of the room, folks yell at each other and the person convening the room, and then you leave without a whole lot of agreement, a little bit more trauma than everybody had when they got together, and the illusion of participatory government. I mentioned that was my saltiest, but if I'm being more fair and more measured, I don't know, I wouldn't change much, but the goal is participatory government, right? Like, it's not just we have elected officials and staff and they do all the things all the time. This is genuinely a way to solicit voices from across the community. I think the challenge is if you don't attend to those dynamics, everything is going to default towards privileging whiteness. Mm-hmm. Everything is going to default towards privileging affluence. And we don't, in the current system of community engagement, which is typically, if you're conducting a project, whether it's, you know, something about the tree line trail or land use planning or anything at all, community engagement is literally a checkbox in the list of the project. It's not intended to attend to the relationship between constituents in a community and its governance. It's not intended to really substantially increase people's interaction or information. It's just intended to, like, let's get through this. We know it's going to be a sweat. Let's do it. Let's get in the room. Let's get out of the room and let's go on.
So what I want to hold in terms of thinking about community engagement, because you are thinking about it through this lens of government and politics and that sort of piece. And it's so much more than that. I think what my supposition is that moving expeditiously, processes that don't value spaciousness, there's hurried schedules, things like that. Who has access, time, availability, and we know that impacted communities, underrepresented and marginalized communities have fewer of those resources. And so while the intent might be, yes, we want to engage community, the impact is very different. Then we're dealing with ostensibly the fallout of that, which is then things get designed with a very narrow representation of people, of ideas, et cetera. And I think that then leads to a lack of innovation, a lack of opportunity for more people to experience a city, a project, an organization, a design, whatever, right? In the ways that perhaps were intended. And I think a lot of people are frustrated with how the process goes, but don't know what to do. And with Catherine, we've been able to explore that because we had resource, access, time. It's all a process in my mind, of us deprogramming, decolonizing, bringing dignity and humanity into everything. Yeah.
So Molly, do you think that that's both the salty version and the fair version? Like, did I get it?
Yeah. Yes. Well, and I feel like with Yodit's version, we have the, what it could and should be version, and the sort of broader understanding of both the community and community engagement and the engagement of it. So that's extremely helpful. So then I guess the next question is, what are, like, let's talk about some examples that might be familiar, examples of community engagement that we've seen in the city. And then maybe this is too soon, but leading up to the example that you two have been working on together, which is the Catherine Street project.
One of the examples that I love to talk about and think about, because I think this one went well, is before the pandemic, the Downtown Development Authority of Ann Arbor did engagement around the People Friendly Streets projects. Specifically, this was when the William, First, and Ashley, and Huron, I think elements were coming up. And it was inviting folks to say, this is where bike facilities would work. This is where the crosswalks feel particularly precarious. This is where I'd love to be able to sit and take a load off my feet, you know, for a while. This is where I don't feel like the lighting works for me if I'm walking in this area. And part of the reason that I think they got the engagement right there was, first of all, they went physically a lot of different places, including into people's homes. And they also were mindful about engaging Housing Commission residents, Delonis clients, and other folks who actively use the downtown and are often not actively solicited. And in the end, I think resulted in a number of city facilities and infrastructures that I think work for a lot of people in a lot of different ways without being these massive interventions. Like one of my favorites is at First and Liberty, where the corner where Blank Slate Ice Cream is. They added benches in across the street and the like light bulb lights strung up across the road there. And it is like the most congenial place to spend a little time. And they put more plants there. So like you sit and you have an ice cream and you watch all the dogs go by, if you're me, or the kids go by, if you're somebody else. And like, it feels like a community I want to live in. So that's an example of community engagement that I think has gone well.
We started off talking about Champions for Change. So I want to tell a little bit about when it hasn't gone well and what I've learned. I was very motivated by vocalizing and addressing the racial leadership gap in Washtenaw County. I had watched organizations, clients of ours, groups I'd served on the board with, just repeatedly listen to and hear the same small group of voices over and over again. I was really over white women telling me, that context being that the majority of nonprofits in the country, but in Washtenaw County as well, are led by white women, are led by folks who often have social work backgrounds, and all of that has flaws in it as well. And so it was uncomfortable to sit in rooms and hear white folks talk about what Black and Brown folks needed, what working class folks needed. And in your world, I'll never forget sitting in the county building during the time when we were building up to the affordable housing millage and realizing that affordable housing was being used as, it was weaponized as like a code word to describe folks who didn't sort of fit the like who was supposed to be in Ann Arbor, right? And that was a deeply traumatizing experience for me, just because a part of my story is like my mom selling the home we owned in Detroit to move onto Green Road into an apartment where this collision of just the city's racist history, but also the way it did housing development in the 60s, 70s, 80s, after all of the hubbub around that. So what I really saw is a lot of ineffective engagement. And as a result, engagement involves representation as well. So I want to be explicit about that. That then it meant that I'd be talking with boards or talking with CEOs of organizations who had no diverse idea, perspective, identity, or experience informing how they were going about program development, how they were going around issue identification, how they were going around solution creation. And it was frustrating, really, really frustrating and painful, frankly, to see those folks coming back and coming back. And so the irony is, though, that I got so excited about Champions for Change and so excited that the genesis of Champions for Change was only a fellowship for leaders of color. And the idea was that we were going to develop a pipeline, if you will, of more leaders of color to address the lack of representation. And the history was the journey that you helped design, Jess, was intended to empower and embolden them so that they knew the ancestors and the living giants whose histories we're bringing forth. And so, I don't know, maybe like 6 months into the process, we met with too late. We met with some elders in the community, and I was, and it just so happened, like, they know my mom and whole nine. I was like, here's
working on? Isn't this amazing? And oh, by the way, as we've been doing this community engagement process, we heard from lots of leaders of color, like, this program sounds great for us, UOD, but if you are not addressing these white-led institutions we're in, it's going to have limitations. And so what started as a leaders of color fellowship expanded to include white folks with these parallel tracks. And when I tell you, I went to these two Black women elders with my, and they were like, that shit's terrible. And oh, by the way, we've been trying to do this for 35 years. It was a really tough day, but it was also very humbling to think about. And I offer that because for folks who are listening, embracing the fact that we get it wrong often and being supple and being humble and being pliable is super important. And that was a lesson I learned in that process, is before we even engage, who is helping us think about design? Whose support do we need? What elder needs to bless the project, right? What community member needs to bless the project? And it took years to repair the unintended damage that I'd done. And so when we think about community-driven planning, it has to begin with reckoning with histories, reckoning with traumas, reckoning with the realities that many in our community have often tried to do the things that we're trying to do, and for whatever reason have had that stopped or had it the process be flawed, et cetera. But that was a really humbling experience and one that is informing my practice and Jess and I's approach with Future Room and with Catherine. You want to talk about Catherine?
I mean, let me ask you some questions to get us started about Catherine. What is the Catherine Street Project?
So the Catherine Street Project is kind of the result of a couple of different things. One is the Affordable Housing Millage in 2020, which Ann Arbor overwhelmingly passed. And I keep coming back to that as one of the sources, because it is not a given that cities fund affordable housing. Ann Arbor is still an anomaly. Is it enough? Absolutely not. We have so much more to do. But I just want to affirm for other communities who may be listening that this can happen. And then the other one was before 2018 and 2019, the city commissioned a study of city-owned lots and their appropriateness for development as affordable housing. Something like 20 sites were on the original study. Something like 10 or 12 were designated as potential for affordable housing, and the rest, you know, either for sale or for use for other city purposes. But the Catherine Street parking lot, the one behind what used to be Out Bar, what used to be the Common Language Bookstore, right across from the co-op, the farmers market, that beautiful mural on 4th, that city-owned parking lot, what came up as one of the very first to be eligible for what's called LIHTC, low-income housing tax credits, funding. And so that percolated up as a potential for affordable housing. Fast forward a couple of years, and the proposal now is a 6-story mixed use, primarily residential, first floor community and tenant services, and then 5 floors of apartments.
And the LIHTC is a federal program.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's worth noting that it's run through the IRS and not HUD. The primary source of all funding for housing is not through any housing department. It's through tax credits. And again, I want to keep calling that out, because we are not funding our housing commitments. And I think that that's important to recognize as well.
So what are the different entities involved in making this development happen?
So the site is being co-developed by the Ann Arbor Housing Commission and Avalon Housing, a nonprofit housing developer, and they are a provider of support services to unhoused folk. And that's pretty unique in that the Housing Commission chose a nonprofit developer. There's, as you all know, tons of private development happening and tons of hiring of private developers. So it was a big deal that they hired Avalon. Avalon's got a rich history both with the city and in developing affordable housing. And where sort of insert our work is before the pandemic, sort of what Jess described was unfurling. There was an RFP put out
to develop the project Avalon, applied, the pandemic is happening, right? And so the process has slowed down a little bit. They even had begun some engagement work, which got difficult in terms of going into people's homes and things like that during the height of the pandemic. And so in early 2022, Avalon's RFP was accepted. And so they were then selected as the co-developer. I have a history with Avalon through New and through helping that organization build its muscle around racial justice and racial equity. And its CEO, Aubrey Patino, reached out to me to say, hey, and I think this is important when we talk about some of the flaws of community engagement. So by the time Aubrey reached out to me, the RFP had already been accepted, which meant the design of the space had essentially already kind of been pitched to the city. And so in that way, the engagement process that she asked me to lead was one that was intended to react to something that had already essentially been designed.
So if I could interrupt for just a second. Yeah. So when it comes to especially residential development, the way that community engagement is often defined is by a radius around the physical address of the project. So whether it's 100 feet, 500 feet, 1,000 feet, you know, whoever is closest gets to say what happens to it. And on its surface, that seems to make sense, right? Like adjacent, you are the most proximate physically to what's happening. The kind of logic goes, you should get a say in what's going on. The challenge is, who gets to be that person? And in Carytown, that was a particular tension because this is a primarily white, extremely affluent, even for Ann Arbor section of town, in a place that a very short number of decades ago was an historically Black business district and neighborhood. And so when we're soliciting community feedback based on radius, we are saying whose voices get to matter. And I just, like, in terms of timing, Yodita, I just wanted to bring that
up. No, it's super important. And when Aubrey reached out to me, she said, this process moved quickly. Like, we got notice in January that our proposal was accepted. Things are moving. And Aubrey knew about Champions for Change, knew about the Washtenaw historical journey. And they also knew about the history of this neighborhood and wanted to pay homage to it. But at that point, what they had was the idea that this six-story building, there would be five floors of residential housing, half of that committed to permanent supportive housing, which is what Avalon's core work is around, and then the other half below market rate rents too. And they had worked with an organization called ArtSpace that designs affordable housing for artists. And so given the population that was going to be in the building, the thought was, and if we can invite artists into this space, that you might be able to develop beautiful community there in the midst of, as Jess said, this very affluent, very white area. And there were fears and concerns about stigma associated with folks moving out of houselessness into this space. And so in addition to that, reckoning with the fact that the building was itself being built adjacent to and in an area that had had its Black history erased. And in fact, the adjacent neighborhood had been renamed, now referred to as Water Hills. So there's a lot of history, a lot going on there. And the idea that they had, at least that they pitched in the early proposal, was to put a business incubator with a focus on Black and Brown, Indigenous, people of color, entrepreneurs. And when Aubrey came to me, the idea was laughable to me, frankly. I don't even know, I maybe know of two Black businesses in all of Ann Arbor, only one of them in downtown Ann Arbor. And for all the things that are beautiful about Ann Arbor, very few of them are attractive to me or to my Black friends. So it's not like I'm coming to Ann Arbor for anything other than to work. I can't afford to live there. And so it just didn't sit with me that we were going to put a business incubator, that the story was that that was going to help to rebuild wealth. Little known fact, some of my work before I got to Ann Arbor was in small business development, and small businesses are really hard to open and sustain, and they require lots of support, lots of safety net, lots of investment. And I'd spent the prior 2 years doing a study of economic opportunity in Washtenaw County for Black and Brown folk, and it wasn't there. So I was a skeptic, but I adore Aubrey. had worked closely enough with her to know that our values aligned, and I was willing to explore the process. Now, I haven't worked in housing as deeply as Jess or as deeply as Jennifer Hall, who's at the Housing Commission, or Aubrey. And so pretty quickly recognized that it would be useful to have other advisors like Jess on that project. What I was most interested in is getting proximate to folks who had lived experience and being in that neighborhood and listening to them. And so that was what I recommended, was let's put together a community leadership council. I've been in deep study with some work that was happening in Memphis. I want to shout out Claiborne Temple and Anasa Troutman, who first introduced me to this idea of a community leadership council and what it really meant to seed and share power. Decision-making power is what we mean, to lift up the hood, to make transparent every element of the project, and to give folks an opportunity to talk about, to learn, to guide and shape that process. And even though we were coming in, really, it was community engagement. If you think about engaging in an idea that already exists, what the future I long for looks like is before we ever even, the ideas emerge from the community, and then we're building and creating, envisioning, and making possible what it is that those communities want, as opposed to the other way around. But in the case of Catherine, it was pretty close to a baked idea, except for the first floor. And so our job was to think about how to honor the history of this community, how to create a space that might invite more people home to Ann Arbor, and specifically to the Carytown area, who had previously called that those streets and those blocks and those homes home. And then how to challenge some of the thinking, particularly around folks who feel very entitled to that neighborhood and feel very entitled to Ann Arbor and very entitled to who belongs there. And so we embarked on a process. There's 12 in our community leadership council, 12 people, humans. They range in age. They all have ties to that neighborhood, whether they were born there or their mothers purchased homes there or their fathers had businesses there or their grandparents helped make Wheeler Park possible. So beautiful, beautiful histories. And yeah, that's what we've been up to.
Yes, in on and up to.
So where does that process stand? Well, I have that question. I have another question that I don't know if we want to go into on the Catherine Street project, about the first floor and parking and the sort of sorry, Jess, I just watched your blood sugar, blood pressure.
No, I mean, we're in therapy session, right? So I've been thinking about this, and I do want to bring this into space because I actually watched two really beautiful transformations happen. I'm still frustrated with where it ended up. So the reason that I noted a few minutes ago about the radius engagement policy is that up to the point where before the RFP even went out, before Avalon was engaged, before EOD was engaged, the only folks that had been quote unquote engaged on the Catherine Street housing project was the Carytown Business District and the old Fourth Ward neighbors, both of which are overwhelmingly, again, overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly affluent. And the business district and the neighbors were both really sensitive to access to parking, first for the small shop owners, and second for farmers market visitors. And women who run the farmers market were there as well. And that was one of their first concerns, was access to parking. And when it became clear that part of the first floor was going to be dedicated to community space, whatever that meant, for me, and I still have not like resolved on my feelings around this, like you guys can't see the deeply uncomfortable body language I'm having with all of this, but I'm just trying to get some of it out of my system, is that it felt like it was either space for cars or it was space for Black history. And we talk on this podcast, things are not a binary. Yodit said at the top of this conversation, things are not a binary. That's how it felt to me. And every person who it felt like was arguing for a parking spot was arguing against Black history, Black present, Black future. That was how it felt to me. And it was a deep, deep tension. And when I came into the project as a consultant, I had to be really intentional about putting what I thought and felt aside and make sure that I was listening really carefully to the conversations that we were having. So when I came in, one of the biggest sensitivities that I heard was around parking. One of the conversations that Yodit and I had was with one of the business managers and participants in the Carytown Business District, whose deep sensitivity was also around parking. She wanted to know what we were doing for cars in the district. And Yodit started by saying, I hear you. Let me tell you a little bit about the genesis of this project and this neighborhood. And by the end of the conversation, the woman had, I don't want to say completely turned around, because she was still really sensitive to the needs of small businesses. And she said, let's talk about how we can continue to support the small business owners while supporting the revisibilization of our history. So watching that happen, and she wasn't the only one, that's happened a number of times, was great. The Community Leadership Council were also folks who were advocating for parking, who wanted to make sure that the residents of the building have enough access, that they are able, that they and others are able to get to the farmers market. And by one of the last conversations of the Community Leadership Council, we met for about a year. And one of the last conversations, one of the council leaned over to me and whispered, I wish we had less room for cars.
Can I jump on that for a second? Because it's so interesting to me. This is not something we talked about community engagement, but what I'm hearing in those stories is that the best community engagement is maybe is both directions, is bi-directional. So we are hearing from and learning from members of the community, the communities, but that also when there are segments, like segments of the community, the business owners of the community, for example, who are not seeing the full picture, community engagement can maybe be an opportunity to move them, bring them along and move them to a deeper understanding. And that's, I hear that a lot in my day job work, where scientists are often like, if only we could properly educate the public, and community engagement it's a one-way flow of, you know, experts to community, and I'm making air quotes all over the place for radio. And we talk about how, no, actually the community members have expertise in a lot of these topics too. But what I'm hearing you talk about is this opportunity to bring the community along that I rarely hear about when we're talking about community engagement. Is that fair? Is that right?
Yeah, I agree with how Jess framed this. I think maybe I could add a little more like color and context. Like, part of what the Community Leadership Council was pushing back on is this idea that folks who have less than the median income don't drive, you know, or that poor people don't have cars. And what Aubrey at Avalon would say is that in our 30-year history, single individuals coming out of houselessness do not own vehicles. The other concern was because of where the location is, there's not access to a grocery store or a pharmacy or what have you. And so members of our Community Leadership Council were thinking about that. Where do they get their prescriptions? How are they going to get to groceries, right? So there were multiple conversations happening, and these deeply held beliefs that needed time to interrogate, to exchange thought partnership around. And I think sometimes the expediency of the engagement process that Jess talked about does not allow for us to get in space and grapple with those ideas where there are multiple truths. And I think that we get these ideological or even sensical notions about how we need to reduce our carbon footprint, so we need to have less cars, and not always like, and just so you know, I thought about you. I understand that the vision that we long for for in our current state, that there needs to be a bridge between that. And I'm willing to work with you to cross that bridge together. Instead, it's like, no, we need fewer cars and fewer parking spaces. And you're a bad person if you want a car. And then people shut down. Or you suck if you're prioritizing, you know, visitors to your small business over folks who are experiencing, because that's white saviorism, right? Over folks, you know, shame on you for wanting, you know, people to be able to park at your small business. That's capitalism, and not thinking of, right, when in reality, that's people's livelihood as well. And almost always, at least in all of my experience, we can do hard things and we can do multiple things, right? So we can make sure that folks have access, which is part of what the Housing Commission has done. There'll be a car on site at Catherine that folks can loan out and can utilize. And we do want to make sure that people can access the farmers market, including the people in Catherine, not just folks who are coming from remote locations or coming in to shop there. And we all got to take a little bit of a haircut, right? Which is what, when we're really designing with and not for, we're thinking about how can we meet those multiple needs. And for me, it's never either or, but it is about who is more often benefiting. And in this case, and in most engagement processes, the folks that benefit are the folks that show up in the room. So the flaw is who, you know, or the hack is who's in the room and whose voices do we value? So when those elders were talking about what it meant for them to have parking spaces, just listen, literally. Yeah. And often what people want is to be heard and to know that you've considered what matters to them.
And I would love to like pinch and zoom on that for a second, because that was a learning moment for me as well, something that I think I'm going to be processing for a while. So again, before Avalon had come in, the community engagement that had been done previously, there was an emphasis on retaining as much parking as possible. And there was this sense of, we don't want this development coming in to change how we access this community, right? Like that was kind of the feeling that I got. And then when the Community Leadership Council started meeting, we started talking about, you know, parking and access. There was a similar conversation, but it was a super different driver. There was, we want to preserve as much parking as possible because we want the residents to have as much access as possible. And that was something that I heard over and over again. This, I don't want to say anxiety because that's not what it was, but this like deep solicitousness for the residents coming into this building, that they are going to feel welcome to this community, that they're going to be and feel resourced, that they're going to have access to the things that they need. And that was the shift, a shift for me, because I had a lot of shifts in this project, but understanding that the thing we're talking about is rarely ever the thing we're talking about. That's not new, but making sure that I understand who I'm listening to. I think I tuned my ears a lot this year, because hearing that concern for the incoming residents, the why of what we advocate for matters. That's the best way that I know to say it.
Yeah. So I'm looking at the time and I'm looking at our little notes document, and we have here in all caps, community colon shifting power. And I think maybe now is the time to start for us to start talking about. So we've zoomed in, and now I'd love for us to maybe zoom out a little bit and start talking about the kinds of power shifts that you both are working towards, and the vision that Yodit started us off with of like what community engagement can and should be.
Go. Yeah, maybe again, we could briefly just define power. And again, like community engagement, for years, I heard people talking about empowering others. And you cannot do that. People build and empower themselves. They build power and empower themselves. What we, those of us who are more proximate to power, which is around decision-making, is around resource mobilization, is around being able to not only vision, but execute on a vision and bring it to reality, right? Those of us who are more proximate, and there are levels of power, levels of access, but those of us who are more proximate have a responsibility to share and to cede that power. And as we've talked about today, community engagement around these types of projects that are long lasting. This building will be here once it's opened for years and years and years. So every decision that we make now influences the future, the same way the decision to rename a neighborhood contributes to the invisibilization of its history. So we need to be contemplative and thinking about what power levers we have, what access to power, and then how can we intentionally seed and share that? And how do we come alongside folk and communities who are building power themselves? So what we have on Catherine Street and on Ann Street and in the surrounding communities is a history of Black folks building power in the midst of de facto racial segregation, housing segregation, economic segregation in the 20th century in Ann Arbor, right? And so we can draw upon those histories of how they took a slaughterhouse and a junkyard and turned it into Summit Park and Wheeler Park, which many of us enjoy the splendor of now. What was that process like? And how do we pull those wisdoms into thinking about Catherine? So it requires us then to reframe who's powerful. And what we've been socialized to believe is who is powerful is white, who is powerful is cis, who is powerful is wealthy, who is powerful is often male, and who is powerful is holding that power and wielding it against us. And so even those of us that are listening that want to be organizing for change and want to be involved in change have to examine the parts of us that hold on to that belief and that notion. So for me, what has evolved in my politic is moving from a knowing to a learning place in my mind, and then to consciously asking who needs to be here, who do I need to be learning from and listening to? And that is really what happened in the design of Catherine, is we established a set of beliefs that the 12 people in that leadership council could and should be guiding what we do on the first floor. And then where there were gaps in skills or knowledge or expertise, to bring that alongside them. And so part of our process was a 4-month long learning series where we heard from people who had more experience in thinking about development or thinking about design and production, community-based production, and thinking about solidarity economies, and just to expand the lens with which we could look through what was possible in Catherine. So power with, not power over, reflecting on believing, trusting that folks who have experienced some of the worst inequities of this country can actually tell us what the solutions could be. And then using our access to power to amplify their voices, amplify their visions. That's been the journey we've been on in Catherine. And just mentioned, this has been a really exceptional project in that there's been the money, the time, the resource, and the will on the part of the actors involved to engage in a process so counterintuitive to how so many of us have previously been involved in engagement. And in that way, sharing the time, the resources. By the way, this was a generous contract, of which more than half of it went to the community leaders, because they were consultants on the project, just like I was. So this isn't just about feel good or sharing power ideologically. You got to share the receipts to the checks, the Dallas. But that's what's on my mind, and it's what I hope folks in this community will continue to think about, is the history of Black organizing, the history of Black freedoms, and the history of Black women leading our collective liberation.
Yeah, to take a year to make a decision about a community space is what was needed. And I want to appreciate the Housing Commission and Avalon for not always knowing what was coming, but working to trust the process. When I'm thinking about what's changing, recently I've started having this imagining of a city that interacts with its community members differently. Like right now, most municipalities are constructed in departments, because departments are a really good way to get things done. But it's not a relational way to deal with people, to deal with constituents. And so when you've got a budget survey and a transportation survey and a housing survey and a priority survey and a community safety survey, when you've got 17 surveys out to people with very little context for the cost benefit analyses of these, for how they interact with each other, we are putting a huge load on people without really attending to how context matters for the questions that we're asking. So I'm starting to conceive of a totally different relationship that municipalities have, where instead of just being departments that execute, there is a way in which government as a whole interacts with the community in a much more relational way. You know, what you're talking about coming alongside people who already have hopes and dreams and power, and you were listing the identities earlier of folks who hold power. We often think of power as held by institutions, when power is held by people, and change is enacted by people. Mm-hmm. And I think that we forget that. And civics is a place where we abandon humanity, and community engagement is a place where we abandon the tender parts of ourselves. And that is where like innovation, creativity, and change live. And so I don't know that I'm working towards it yet beyond having conversations that push me and being at work that pushes me. But I can see through Catherine what it looks like for institutions to engage with its community in a much more human way. And man, that looks hard, and it looks like hope. Did we do the thing, y'all?
Are there any other pieces of this that either of you wanted to wrestle with or just share a bit while we're talking about these things? I feel like this one, Jess, you came in with just like, I'm going to get to talk to Yodit about this thing that I think about all the time. But I just want to give a moment for like, we always have this thing 10 minutes after we hit stop where it's like, I wish I really wanted to talk about whatever and I totally forgot. So I'm trying to like, give us that moment right now.
I think what is surfacing for me is words like dignity and humanity. And, you know, just when you were talking about like institutions and community, I think that institution building often interrupts dignity and humanity because we have to create systems and processes, and we're often designing from really harmful, violent ways we've learned how to organize ourselves. And so even the best intended processes are replicating that violence and harm. So what would a city look like where those lines between the institution and the community were more blurred, more fluid, where we really were a representative, that our governance was representative of the people, by the people, for the people. So that's on my mind. It is what I'm working towards, is dismantling institutions and systems in favor of people and our capacity to organize ourselves. And I think the larger the institution gets, the harder it is to continue to maintain dignity, humanity. And I've seen that across institution. The other thing that I want to mention is that was kind of bubbling up for me is, at least for all of my life, my 50 years, I can attribute much of who I am and how I move in the world to the love of Black women and to the histories of Black women globally organizing for their own freedoms and liberation, but also for the freedom and liberation of all people. And so when I look at the faces of the 12 community leaders that we've worked with, not all of whom identify as women, but there is the reverence for those Black women elders in that group and a belief that our freedom is tied to theirs. So I think the other thing that we have to be thinking about as members of this community is the ways in which our freedom and liberation is tied to one another. We are not here to fix people, to save people. We are here to get free together.
Awesome. There's lots of silent Jess happiness. Yes. We had like the blood pressure spike earlier, and now we're in a good place.
Mm-hmm. Let's celebrate a couple of things. The first thing that I want to mention is to really celebrate that Garrett Space rezoning passed this week. So we are going to see, the development of a mental health treatment and recovery facility for young folks experiencing real difficulty coming up in Washtenaw County. So really delighted. Thank you to all the community members who spoke, wrote, thought, sent good energy, and to the Halperts for holding the treasured memory of their son and bringing that out to the community in a way that can serve a lot of people. Just super excited about that.
And another piece of good news in Ann Arbor was the passage of the driving equality ordinance, which I think we spoke briefly about in the transportation feelings episode, but this is an ordinance that will end many kinds of secondary traffic stops for things like broken taillights that we know are disproportionately used against people of color and especially Black men, and that they lead to a lot of harm and do not really do much or anything in the way of safety. And so Ann Arbor has officially passed that ordinance, and we are one of the first cities in the country to do so. So it is a big deal, and like huge, huge props to Councilmember Cynthia Harrison, who was the leader of that effort. All right. That's it for this episode of Ann Arbor AF. Huge thanks to Yodit for joining us today. Come check out past episodes and transcripts at our website, annarborAF.com. Keep the conversation going with fellow Ann Arbor AFers on Twitter, if you're still there, at the A2 Council hashtag, and Facebook in the Ann Arbor Housing for All Facebook group. And if you want to send us a few dollars, at ko-fi.com/AnnArborAF to help with our hosting costs. We always appreciate it. We're your co-hosts, Molly Kleinman and Jess Leeta, and thanks as always to producer Scott Trudeau. Theme music is I Don't Know by Grapes. Get informed, then get involved. It's your city.